Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hi, this is Greg Bresnitz, one half the host of Snacky Tunes. We have had the honor of being nominated by Taste Awards for Best Radio Show and Best Podcast. Please head to bit.do/stvote in order to vote for Snacky Tunes and other food favorites. Once again, that's bit.do/stvote. And a big congratulations to Heritage Radio Network for being nominated into the Hall of Fame. Thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth, Wisconsin, makers of the world's best cheese and pioneers in the U.S. artisan cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We talk about food. Talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Where you can call me, shake me, and wake me. Leave the messages on my phone. You got a new boy living with you. So tonight this boy ain't home. If you say goodbye, that I had mistreated you. Still late in the night, you beckoned me home. Salutations to you and your love too.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Sam Bresnitz.
And I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz.
Together we make one full host of Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network. We are joined by the amazing chef, Taco Slinger, Man About Town, Wes Avila. Welcome to Snackytunes.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Did you bring any tacos?
I get the question every single time. Every single time. Oh, yes, I did.
You should have made something that was less transportable. It's like if you just went into like filet mignons or like, you know, whatever. Well, I guess this would take.
Yeah. In today's modern age, you can pretty much transport anything.
Do you?
Do you like playing tacos?
Because I heard.
Thanks for coming. It was so nice having you here. We appreciate it.
So you are one of the, I don't want to say unique, but you are lifelong, born and raised Angelino.
Yeah, I was born and raised here in Los Angeles. Grew up in a suburb right outside of LA in Pico Rivera. And yeah.
How much does Los Angeles mean to you as far as like, when you take a look on your whole life and when you wake up and see what you built and the food that you make, that you can trace it back to when you were a kid?
I think growing up here in Los Angeles, it's become part of me. Like I see, I love the city. Like when I go out and visit all these other countries and other cities, and I see the things that I really like and kind of picture myself living there. And you know, I really think about that. And when it comes back to it, like I love Los Angeles. And I don't think I can realistically ever live anywhere else.
For all the people who are moving here, like my brother, what is the mile marker year of becoming a true Los Angelino? In New York, it's said to be 10 years. What does it take to become a true?
I think once you drop your hometown baseball team and root for the Dodgers, I think you can consider yourself an Angelino.
Well, I had to do that on day one, so my wife would marry me, so I guess I'm an Angelino.
You know, growing up in... You grew up in Pico Rivera, correct?
Yes.
And that was a real smorgasbord of hodgepodge of food growing up, correct? It wasn't just like Mexican food or South American food, it was like
Mexican food. Pretty much Pico Rivera is like, my high school was like 90% Mexican, 8% other, and like 2% black.
Right.
But my school, where I grew up, was very Mexican, very South American. And you did have some stuff like some Thai food and things like that, but for the most part, it was Tex-Mex at home,
yeah,
fast food, and when you ate out, it was maybe something like Chickies, something like that.
Yeah. Really? And so then when did you start realizing that there was another, like at 20 young age, you start realizing there's a whole other world of food out there?
Well, actually, like, there was basically two worlds. There was here where I grew up in Pico Rivera, and
sure,
then there was Mexico when I go to, like, Baja with my dad or my parents and actually eat some of the seafood down in Ensenada. You get 90-day stuff there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you get, like, live clams and oysters and things like that. So that was definitely a part of my growing up. And then here in LA was like the fast food kind of Tex-Mex stuff. But when I really realized like, fuck, there's like so much other stuff, that it was more, it was probably when I started culinary school cooking like that.
Isn't that such an awesome moment when you go like, oh, I don't know anything.
Yeah.
And what I don't know seems to be insanely delicious.
That happens every time I travel. Every time I eat somebody else's food, every time I visit another country or another culture and see like how different and they treat the same exact ingredient, it always blows my mind. It's always growing something.
But it wasn't just food, also music played a big influence in your life as well.
Oh, music's always been a huge part of my life.
First album, what'd you buy?
First album that I bought, like, honestly, was probably the Time Life 1957 rock and roll compilation.
That is awesome.
That's a real answer.
That is a real answer.
You never believe people like, oh, I bought the Sex Pistols.
That's not bad. Yeah, you know, no.
My life.
Okay. I got really into La Bamba and like got into rock and roll.
Oh my god.
I started getting into old rock and roll. Really, like,
you know, when I eat your tacos, I taste La Bamba.
Yeah. That's not a bad thing.
But see, with the music, and so at what point were you just like, I love music? Like, did you think that a career in music or DJing or anything that might be your path to like creativity?
Well, I had cousins from Indiana that were DJs, and they introduced me to like breakdancing and hip hop and early 80s hip hop. And so they had like vinyl, and like it was always like vinyl. Even then, like when you get the CDJs there, and even best now these clients for computers. But it was just like
as former clowns with computers.
Yeah, but you know, it cannot the understatement and appreciation of having like cool older brothers or cousins can never go unsaid, especially when it comes to music.
I mean, and then it started from there, started hip hop there, and then coming back to LA was like that's when just hip hop just was like the peak, you know, and got into really like the house scene and like. And then as I grew older, I got into like, well, you know, like, you know, Tribe Called Quest, and you start hearing like, what did they sample? And you start hearing records that they sampled, and you start going digging, and you know, within this community. You just get bit by a bug and want to go. It's interesting to see the lineage of both music and food and how you're like, oh wait, how was that dish made? Let me go back and see where their body comes from. The same thing happens with music.
Yeah, absolutely. As you get people who are influenced by or they apprentice under somebody and they get their style a little bit, maybe morph it, which turns into their own, like in a couple years. You know, like in the last 12 years, I've worked for different chefs, so you learn here, there, and
what can you, I mean, and we'll get to this a little bit later, but just since you brought it up, is there something in your cooking life that you have held on to for a decade or more that now shows up in your truck?
As far as...
like an ingredient or a coach or anything like that?
Probably getting whatever ingredient it is that's the best and just kind of presenting it simply. That's one of the earliest lessons I had in the kitchen. It's like, you can get a, you know, you can get a really beautiful piece of fish, but if you have a cook that doesn't know what he's doing, you can ruin it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So let's go back to, so you're in your teenage years. Mm-hmm. Food was not
a big deal.
No,
I played sports, so I ate like not very well. I ate a lot and worked out a lot. But music at the time was super important to me.
Yeah.
And that's when I started getting into DJing and doing house parties and being a big part of the LA like backyard party fires.
Was that awesome?
Thanks.
Did you ever DJ?
Yeah, it was
So you after high school, you went out and actually became a teamster, right?
Yeah. My dad had been working at this place. Like he immigrated here like in the mid-70s, started working at this factory in Whittier. That actually started in Sunken Springs and moved to Whittier and back to Sunken Springs. And then I basically just followed his footsteps, so he hated that. He did not like me out there.
Really?
Yeah, because he's like, I didn't come to this country so you can, like, do exactly what I do, so he did not like it.
So when you were, like, after a few years being a teamster, you're like, I'm going to go be a chef, and like, go cook.
Yeah, when I decided to leave, he was very supportive. He's like, I don't care, I don't want to leave, or what you do, but he's like, go do something else. It didn't matter what, but just don't do what I do.
And as someone who wasn't into food and industry, where, how did you make the transition, or where did the inspiration come from to go to the Culinary Institute?
Well, I've always enjoyed eating, like, a lot. You
sure.
Know what I mean? So it's like, but I still, even in my mid-20s, I didn't eat at, like, fancy places or anything like that.
Yeah, but being in LA, eating at a fancy place doesn't mean you're not eating a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
So what were you eating? What were you eating, and what did that transition start looking like? I think I can do this.
Probably when I go to like Rosarito or Ensenada and eat lobster or,
sure,
you know, go to really good like Unicorn back in like the early 2000s, you know, for Thai food and tasting things and like trying to make them at home and being able to make them without looking at a recipe and just like by memory. And I was like, maybe I'm not good at this. So
how are you able to, like, what is that thing? That's a lot of people. So I was like, oh, I can actually make this at home. What skills were you pulling from that you knew how to actually, like, cook and break things down and get things to taste well?
It might not have been, like, the techniques that I had. I definitely had zero technique, but as far as flavors and ingredients on the right way to do it, like, I find the right path. Like, this has this kind of, this has ginger, this has this, they have that, you know, and, like, being able to decipher and, like, kind of put together, but adding it, those skills into it much later, like, actually more training.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick musical break, and we're going to then talk about your entry into the fine dining scene, and we'll be right back on Snacky Tunes. And we're back. We're coming live from you, Taste Talks LA, with Wes Avila of Gorilla Tacos. So after you left the Teamster world and you started cooking, you went to cooking school.
Yes.
Which, you know, there's an argument now that cooking school is maybe the path, but not the path, but for you, who seems, you know, it seemed like the right thing to do, just to like get in there and to understand how it worked.
At the time, I didn't think there was any other way. I didn't think I could have learned,
sure,
ever open doors. And in, you know, hindsight, you know. But now I would tell a young cook, if a young cook was like, I want to think about going to corner store, I want to learn these things, I'd be like, don't waste your time. At least not in America. Not, it's too expensive for what we get.
I mean, it's like $50,000-$60,000.
It's more than that. But honestly, go to a junior college and get that kind of general,
sure,
like bulk kind of like cooking and some kind of basics down. I am totally supportive about that. But if you're going to go to culinary school, I'd say go to a cooking school. Go to, you know, go to one in France, go to one in Spain. Get something different. Throw something different in your belt. If you don't learn the language, submerge yourself and learn it. Because it will push you and challenge you. If not, you'll just be like everybody else, because a lot of the kids that I went to school with, they aren't kids anymore, don't cook anymore. Like, even immediately as soon as you got out of school, like, I'd say 70% of the class was like, this isn't for me. And you went and spent, you know, 70 to 80 grand. And so, like, there's, like, professionally, there's four people in the class of 80 that I know that are still cooks. But they're all, like, pretty high up, like some of their careers.
But, I mean, if you look at food as an art, it's, you know, in that creative field. Making in that creative field is tough. And, like, sticking it out, I mean, you could be a grinder. You could be on the line for 20, 30 years. But to, like, have them say, do what you do, it's rare. Even for those talented people.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is timing and just luck. Like, we started to do Gorilla Tacos. I mean, to be completely honest, before, a lot of people were doing tacos with sweet potatoes and tacos with, like,
sure,
you know, ingredients like that. So we kind of found, like, that all the time, and then we started seeing other people, like, kind of like in other cities doing the same thing, which was really cool. And it became kind of like a movement, like the California thing.
Yeah.
You know, so that it just kind of, like, you know, like, it just was time for this kind of emergence of food style to come up.
So you have a strong background in fine dining. How did that get started? A lot of chefs talk about, like, when they first stepped into the first, like, fancy kitchen. What did that do to your mind and your insights and sensibilities? When did it start?
It started in 2005. I went up to the British Crown Office. I read about this restaurant in Blanton, and I happened to have time off. I went up and traveled up there, and really enjoyed the, I really enjoyed the vibe. Like, we went in there, and it was probably maybe 10 tables with, like, a couple of deuces on them. So at the most, there was probably 20 people in there.
Yeah.
And then when I went back to meet the chef, there was 6-7 cooks.
Wow.
And it looked like a hospital room. It was beautiful, clean, white. There's no clanging, and yelling, no swearing, no. You can barely hear what they're doing. The move looked like almost like ballet like moves, you know? So that, like, blew my mind. Like, it doesn't have to be like a slop house, like,
yeah.
Just like hack style cooking, you know what I mean? Like, it was very elegant and very unique. And it really attracted me to want to push myself like that, because it was completely different than anything I had been exposed to, even in corner school at that time. So I, you know, went up there, Saj, and I got invited to go and cook, and I ended up there with, you know,
And what was that? I mean, was that, you would say, like, a big transformative moment for you?
That was definitely a big transformative moment. Because, like, before that, I didn't really have any, it was two places I was going to go. I was either going to go to New Orleans and go cook, or I was going to go to Central California to cook. And I'm glad I chose Central California, because that was literally the same August Katrina happened. So, like, I moved up to Carmel in July, so it was very possible. I was looking at this to move to New Orleans, and I was like, no, I think this is more my style. It's California. Like, the chef, he's from here. He's doing some really interesting stuff. And so I decided to stay, and that's the moment that, like, after I worked there and, like, experienced that, like, that I really like that kind of high end of cooking. But one of the things that stuck with me in my career is I went and staged at Maurice. I met Brendan Collins there, and I remember he gave me advice that I'll never forget. And he said something along the lines, because I was bouncing around from different restaurants to try to go out of Berlin. And he's like, Wes, if you stay in fine dining, just prepare to give up how you lived in Carmel. Prepare the same thing here, because it's much harder. You have to give up, like, you know, holidays and basically everything that I kind of knew, which I really put in perspective, was like, you will never ever, like, make a living to pay your student loan doing fine dining until you get to a certain level. And, like, he was absolutely right. So I basically kind of pulled away from that and just started looking for work that would actually pay my bills. And so that's kind of
the
that.
So this whole time you've been cooking in California, did you ever start to think that you might want to go abroad or get out of the state to get like a little bit more experience before you started your own in California?
Yeah, I didn't set out to start my own thing. I didn't have a plan, like, okay, in 2 years I'm going to start my own thing. It was more, I'm working with a chef and I want to keep getting more experience with my belt. So, and that's when I went to, around the time that I went to France. And then I went to Paris, and there's a center for my son that I'm in class. And then...
No big deal.
No, well, I mean, it's just, I mean, it's a school, and it's... But they,
just a school.
It's
just a school.
It's very, very intense.
Just a Harvard, just
and
a school.
I didn't speak the language, so I spoke a very broken French-Spanish hybrid, which
sure.
I'm very cool with. And, like, I was the only brown guy there. I mean, it's like, so they're, like, they were really cool. They're, like, they find out where I was from LA, and they're like, oh, can you listen to your dog? Like,
no, I know.
Yeah. Don't ask any more questions.
So, you finished with Europe, and it seems like you have this passion for music, this passion for LA, you have this background, everything's built up. when did everything start to fall into place and you start to go on this own path, knowing that you want holidays off and can't do fine dining all the time? Like, when did everything start to coalesce into your current situation?
Well, it was almost by accident. I was working about 4 days a week at Encontro, which is a pop-up, which can be open a certain amount of time, so it started little by little, like, my savings started getting smaller, smaller, smaller.
Sure.
And I had less and less money by, like, working these hours, so I was like, I need to do something on the side to, like, supplement my income. So that's when I went and started. I had a cart that I bought for a family party. We used this cart. I called up one of the owners for Hanson Coffee, and I was like, I got this cart. Mind if I set up? He's like, yeah, bring on down. So I went on down, and...
What year is this?
This is 2012. This is August of 2012.
Isn't it so nice when people are just like, yeah, can we... Yeah, they say yes.
Yeah, he was just like, yeah, sure, come on down. He was like, Carolina LA is not going to be anymore, but they moved to location.
Sure.
So we had that slot open. So I came in, started selling tacos, didn't know what I was doing at all, didn't have change, didn't have a tent. It was like 102 degrees, humid, had a barbecue, like cooking on the fire. It was insane, but it was like awesome.
And then in the early days, what did the menu look like?
The first day, I'll tell you, was garden salad chicken.
Just that?
Just that's it. And then like the week after that was garden salad chicken and then potato and corn. And then after that, I was like, I asked some of the customers, like, if I got better ingredients, would you guys pay a little bit more? And they're like, yeah. So they went from $2 tacos to $3 tacos, and then started getting better ingredients and better ingredients and better ingredients and stuff that's harder to find. And several sources, like, wanting to get a spirit. I had this guy, he had chickens in, what is this, not Boyle Heights, just north of Boyle Heights, Lincoln Heights. And I drive up the hill, and he'd give me, like, 4 dozen eggs that were, like, all weird sizes for, like, you know, $10.
Yes.
And so I was really into, like, looking, because I was only looking 2 days a week.
Yes.
I had the time to go look for cool shit, so.
And where else were you sourcing from? Where are you getting your muscle from? Where are you getting your other ingredients? And did it harken back, like, the days of, like, digging through crates and records?
It might have been. It might have been something, because I really enjoyed it. I mean, at the time, like, trying to find the most obscure, like, all right, well, this guy will just sell two, so I'm going to do all the stuff, too. So,
yeah.
This guy has, like, all these, like, half-moon scallops. I'm going to take all these scallops. So that's kind of, that's where I went with that.
We're going to take a quick musical break, and we're going to talk about Frito Tacos and its continued evolution, and we'll be right back on Snacky Tunes.
We'll be right back.
students. You're here live at Taste Talks with Wes of Gorilla Tacos. So you're down in LA. You're open 2 days a week. Sounds like sort of a ragtag shuffle sort of setup. And what's the evolution? Because I think it's interesting. You started with two and then three and building a relationship with the customers. How did it continue to evolve until, what was the time frame from going from your cheaper ingredients to where you kind of felt it was a good place and you were serving the tacos and at the quality and the price that you wanted?
I'd say about a month. Because I was like, all right, I need something to separate from what everybody else is doing. You can get carnitas and rolls, so it's pretty good. I have this training, I'm going to use it and get different ingredients. So I started incorporating seafood, I started incorporating more vegetables, and we started opening up in the morning, so we're doing that kind of breakfasty kind of stuff. So it really allowed me to push myself and do like different things. And I was the only cook. I didn't have anybody helping me as far as I could. I cooked everything start to finish, washed everything start to finish. So like my day was basically about 6 a.m. to about 1-2 in the morning.
Yeah.
So
that's a long day.
Yeah, because I'm prepping everything, roasting everything. This is my house. There's no commissary. There's no like partner that helped me like get this awesome space to do this prep. So everything's done in this little apartment in Glendale. Put it in an ice chest. Put it in my truck. Bring it down. Piece it up. And just do it.
And
permits
and
all that.
Were the cops okay with that?
The cops were okay with it. That's why we had the little talk. Because they shut us down. They're like, you guys can't be here. No, let me see your permit. I was like, and I immediately was like, I forgot it. He's like, you forgot your permit? And I was like, yeah, I didn't think I was going to do the inspection. He's like, this is, you know, you can't be over here. So, like, we're going to have to, like, move. We're going to have to, like, shut it down. It was very nice. And we moved to another space. And then that space, the cops went, they were actually like, well, just move it back a little bit so people can walk by the street.
That's nice. And give us four tacos.
And it wasn't so we were doing that for a year, and I loved it. I mean, I was wearing flip-flops. You know, not having to pay for any permits, not having any employees, anything. You know, and so, like, when we got shut down, we were really getting good press. And this is, like, summer of 2013. This is August, almost exactly a year. And the cops came, and they're like, you need to shut down. And we're like, well, can we just give away this food because I don't want to waste it?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, giveaways, you know, just kind of go. But people were leaving $50 tips because they knew we were getting shut down.
That's so awesome.
We were getting shut down. So, the cops were like, no, that's it, party's over. Like,
oh, they started seeing the cookies?
Yeah, they started seeing that we were getting money even for the food. We're like, you don't hear this, please. If you don't shut this down, we're going to confiscate yourself.
Yeah, shut it down. And so then so you knew at some point it had to get a little bit more formal.
Yeah.
And so how did that happen? Was it easy to do it?
No, I wouldn't say it was easy at all. I think it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. Because, like, we went from doing this cart that's completely gorilla within 4 days of getting the food truck and getting every license that we needed to do. So we didn't skip a beat. Like, they shut us down the next week. I left on vacation to Chicago. Well, in Chicago, I orchestrated and organized getting this food truck, getting my permits. And we drove it right up and we're like, because they instantly called the cops to shut us down on that.
Oh, man.
So
who was that?
I have a hint, but I haven't.
Oh, so you know who's
next.
And so around this time when everything starts to coalesce, there's this like unofficial movement that also starts to coalesce of Alta California cuisine. Can you talk a little bit about that and like who else is part of that movement and what goes into it?
Yeah, it's kind of starting like I'd say around 2012, 13, 14. Now it's like kind of a thing. It's like these chefs that are, you know, American, born here, but like parents are Mexican or from South America, you know, and you're grown up with this kind of American feel, but you're very much in tune with your roots. And I'd say the big people that are part of it is probably like Ray Garcia, Carlos Salgado, and Eddie Reese. So, like, I mean, they're doing their food, but with this training that they kind of got from being in the fine dining.
I mean, there has been that big argument, even when you look at Mexico City and Pujol, things like that, about, like, people think of Mexican food as this very, like, cheap, like, dollar taco. But it's actually one of the most complex, delicious. I mean, when you think of a mole, they have 100 ingredients. Like, I'm sorry, you know, the fresh mole salsa has like 4 ingredients.
Yeah.
You know, so you look at these ingredients and these salsas that have all sorts. Like, how do you expect that it's not to have cost more?
Yeah.
And how do you like especially comment that or champion that
when people come to you with like this idea, like, well, this is an authentic, like I can get a dollar from your friend Tom.
We've had that experience when we first opened it, we get a lot more people saying like, I can get these in Highland Park for $1.50. I was like, then go.
Go to Highland Park and go.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, hey, so what am I doing? I'm gonna beg you to stay and buy like my fancy tacos. You know,
yeah.
So it's like, if you don't like it, you know, basically fuck off. You know, so it's like.
did they even buy the taco?
No, one guy straight up, like, I remember at the point that I already had, like, I had people kind of like, would say that, and I explained to me, at the time I was very much like, this is why, blah, blah, blah. And most of the time, they're like,
I got 2 dozen different shape size eggs, and I beat them to
death
for you.
Yeah, well, this one guy was like, do you know where you're at? We're in LA. I was like, I'm from LA. Where are you from?
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, fuck you. Like, coming at me like that. And then he's like, well, these tacos are ridiculously expensive, blah, blah, blah. I was like, have one for free. Here, tell me what you think. And he was like, you're
pretty good. Pretty good.
And did he buy a second one?
He bought a second one.
Good for him. Then he's just, yeah, I mean, like, I bought two, but.
And then I started being a little bit smart about, you know, not having like that so standoffish attitude. And somebody was like, you know, this is pretty expensive. It's like $5 for this workout. And they got, like, okay, like, put a swoosh, put a little garnish, put this in here.
I had, you know, when I went there, I had the uni tostada. I was like, you know, this is a plate. If I went to a sit down restaurant where they serve uni, like, this is going to be $15-$20.
Easy.
And I. Was there anything in your experimentation that didn't translate in
a lot
of taco?
A lot of stuff sucked.
One
that was like horrible that like I brought back, and it's actually really good now, is an eggplant taco. The first time I did it was roasted eggplant with fresh chickpeas,
yeah,
and like this burnt tomato chili, and it just didn't work. And then it might have been where we set up too. We were at South Park at that point. We were set up in front of Cafe Dulce, and people did not respond, so I was like, yeah, this is bullshit. So we put it back on the drawing board, and I've done it like, you know, it's actually on the menu like right now this weekend. It's like eggplant and fried cheese, and it's awesome.
That sounds like once you get that fried stuff, you got like a little texture balance that maybe gives it like a little bit more crunch.
Yeah, it just needs something.
Yeah.
Something that was missing. I've done stuff where it's like a complete nightmare, but, you know, you don't serve those things.
Yeah, but maybe eat them at home.
Yeah.
And have you gone back into fine dining kitchens or done any stages as you've done Gorilla Tacos to keep up that side of education?
Actually, no. But my learning, I'm more into learning people's like rustic techniques and things that are. I try not to pay too much attention to trends because they come and go. Like,
yeah.
For a while, when I was like in the middle of my career, like in the beginning, it was a lot of. Everybody's up about LBE, seeing everybody's steaming this, everybody's
sharing
this. And then for a while, and then after that, it was like, oh, it's cool to go forage now. So when you go to the San Diego Mountains and get fucking like mugwort to make beer, that's all the world. You know, it's dry, it's a flower. We're not having this abundant land. I mean,
yeah.
In Northern California, I get it way more, but, and then Worship actually has his own time to go forage that morning, you know? Like, you're not going to find where you're starting not to serve restaurants.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, people watch these TV shows and get so much influence from it that they don't let themselves just kind of eat. And then it's cool to ferment things. We don't have to ferment things. Everything grows in California year-round, pretty much. So it's like, it's not really like I see and like, get different flavors and developing, and I think that's cool, but for, like, people need to be careful with these trends because these things come and go, and they evolve, and, like, you're just, like, this flash in the pan kind of thing.
Yeah. So let's talk about the now and the next. Trump's got a makeover.
Yes.
Who did the art?
Bio.
It looks gorgeous.
Yeah, he did a really good job. He did our first truck.
Yeah.
And after careful consideration of my partner, we decided to go with Vile again, and he killed it. He did such a good job.
And do you find, what made you want to, I mean, the truck's iconic, and, you know, it's sort of like a beacon. I know our buddy Kong was always like, when he's driving past it, he's like, oh, I see the truck, and I recognize the colors, and I, like, start to look for parking. But what made you want to sort of, like, do a fresh coat of paint?
Being from LA, it's always been like a part of it, like the hip hop movement, like I'm graffiti music, you know, DJing, even breakdancing, like the elements. It's always been a huge part of like myself growing up. So on the first part, we had Hex did like this graffiti,
yeah,
Gorilla Tacos on it, and it was very much a part of our thing. So, and then even the people who print up our shirts, there's like Hit and Run crew here based in Los Angeles. They work with, like, he'll do a run of shirts for us, like 20 shirts, I mean, that's it. They change on. I like the 20 shirts. We change it. And it's frustrating to people because they can't get certain prints and things like that, but it kind of keeps it fresh, like how, you know, this idea we have like, for the tacos and things like that.
Do you find that, you know, I mean, now with the current state of food and things like that, that just serving up good tacos or good food anywhere gets you to a point, but, you know, I was like a Hal Raise t-shirt here, and like, it's really awesome to see what happened. It's just, you're building like a brand.
Yeah,
beyond,
just food, and like, I, you know, you look at these smaller places, like the food trucks, it's like, well, I really need to get on a truck, we just need to build out like what we're doing and like have other sort of merchandise and things like that.
Yeah.
Do you find that that's an important part of your growth?
I think it's a very important part because it shows, it has people support, like, you know, that they're down with like our food and like with kind of what we stand for and like just like, you know, being a part of all Los Angeles, you know? So like very much like LA, Los Angeles, like it's part of our branding. It really is part of our branding. I never thought about like our brand, but it's just kind of like, hey, this sounds cool, let me do this. Hey, I know these artists, let me get them to do this. And it was more of a, just kind of a natural thing like that. And now it's more thought out, like, we should work with this guy because he did some really cool work for us. And so that's kind of like, that's
it's awesome. It's like seeing band t-shirts out.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, cool. We're like, we know about that. I'm like, yeah. You waited in line, you got the chicken, you got the taco, you got everything. So what's next?
Brick and mortar.
Yeah.
Why brick and mortar?
It's time.
It's time.
It's time.
The
truck is going to get blown up. It's just like, it's not, I'm sick of the truck. I don't mind the kitchen being that small. I'm sick of, if the truck is late because I'm sick of, the axle broke, the truck crashed.
Sure.
Somebody sideswiped us. Somebody like stole this from the truck. It's just like, it just, so when people say like, oh, there's problems with restaurants, I'm like, I get it. I've worked with those for years before I got this truck. And so when people think the truck is like, oh, I can go open this like little fancy whatever kind of food and it'll blow up, and it's not like that. It's so hard. It's such a hard business.
Can you say where it's going to be?
The brick and mortar?
Yeah.
Yeah, for some good.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
How bad?
Our sister's. I don't know. How big is that? 2,900 square feet.
That's awesome.
Have a patio, full liquor license.
When?
Yeah, when?
Not soon enough.
Summer 17.
Summer 17. Okay, so you still catch the truck a little bit.
You catch the truck for us, the truck for the next half year.
Awesome.
But yeah, we're already picking tiles and with the designs done and we have the space, it's going to happen.
Awesome. Well, we're super excited.
I got one last question for you. So based on the advice from the fine dining about give up your life, give up your weekends, give up everything, what have you found the lifestyle is like with the truck versus what you think you might have had with the fine dining lifestyle?
I give up more than I would have ever with the fine dining. Like, I live, the truck is like literally attached to, at the hip. Like, it's ridiculous how involved I am with it now. And it's like, it's so much more. Being like, you know, the owner and stuff, it's basically.
But would you have changed the thing?
Fuck no.
Fuck yeah. Alright, well, thank you everyone for hanging out. We really appreciate it. We have a live band coming up next in the studio.
And where can people find you, follow you, find the truck for the final 6 months?
Facebook, of course, Grill Tacos, our webpage, and it'll link you up to our Instagram and all that other stuff.
You gotta do something like a shirt for every last month of the truck.
That might be a good idea.
Yeah, thank you.
That's a no.
That was a hard no. That's okay. That's our appreciation. Thank you, everyone, for hanging out.
Thanks for having
me. If anyone has any questions for Chef, Madam Platt.
Thank you. What can we expect from Brick and Mortar when we take it on the truck?
Consistency. Like, we'll have like the tacos that we're gonna do like on the menu that are set and rotate a couple out, and we're gonna have other toys to play with, so we'll be able to do like. Al pastor, and I have, it's not just your basic al pastor, I have these ideas to do these things and I've been working on, but yeah, a little bit more inventiveness on it.
Can we expect, like, every once in a while, like, a dinner, a collab dinner at the restaurant?
Absolutely. The first, like, month is going to be a lot of collaboration dinners with all these chefs that I've done collaborations with over the last 3 years, so
it's like
calling all those favors.
Your playground's, like, gotten bigger.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Yes?
When you're not working, where do you like to eat?
I usually find myself in my neighborhood, so if it's not like Canley, it's probably Porto's or
Porto.
Yeah.
I mean, it's gotta be volume, but it's like you get 90 pounds of food and like it's $12.
Yeah.
There's 45 sandwiches, that's at least 23.
It's a beautiful thing.
It's so good.
I live across the street, so it's like hard for me to not.
Do you have like a zip line where they just like send the sandwich to the house? Any other questions? Anyone?
That's good.
Okay. Hey, well, thank you, everyone, for coming. Really appreciate it. Check out the truck. Stick around. We'll see you all later. Bye.
Don't speak to me this way. Don't ever let me say. Don't leave me again. Don't leave me again. Oh, you never felt this lost before, and the world is closing doors. I never wanted anything more. Oh, you never felt this lost before, and the world is closing doors. I never wanted anything more. Don't hurt me this way. Don't touch me this way. Don't hurt me again. Don't hurt me again. Don't hurt me this way. Don't touch me this way. Don't hurt me again. Don't hurt me again. Oh, you never felt this lost before, and the world is closing doors. I never wanted anything more. Oh, you never felt this lost before, and the world is closing doors. I never wanted anything more. Don't let me make the same mistake again. Don't let me make the same mistake again. Don't let me make the same mistake again. Please don't let me make the same mistake again. Oh, you never felt this lost before, and the world is closing doors. I never wanted anything more. Oh, you never felt this lost before, and the world is closing doors. I never wanted anything more. Don't let me make the same mistake again. Don't let me make the same mistake again. Please don't let me make the same mistake again. Don't let me make the same mistake again.
Have you tasted the world's best cheese? Grand Cru Sauchois is the 2016 World Cheese Champion. Our partners at Roth, Wisconsin make this gorgeous alpine-style cheese in the rolling hills of Greene County, Wisconsin. Grand Cru Sauchois is produced by hand in Swiss copper vats and finished by aging on spruce planks. The quality milk and careful craftsmanship bring out the award-winning light floral notes, nutty undertones, a hint of fruitiness, and a mellow finish. Perfect with Riesling and Muscat, Grand Cru Sauchois is a guaranteed hit for any occasion. Check out their other offerings at rothcheese.com. You'll discover Buttermilk Blue and their newest release, Prairie Sunset, the golden-hued love child of Mimolette and Gouda. You'll also find recipes like the Raclette Reuben and tomato tartlets. Everything you need to know about the world's best cheese is at rothcheese.com.
Welcome back. We got Fletcher C. Johnson and crew in house. Boys, you want to introduce yourselves?
Yeah, I'm John Doherty. I play drums.
I'm Todd Martin. I play the bass.
And I'm Fletcher. You might remember Todd from the last time we did the show.
I do.
He was the paper cutout that we brought in.
Oh, yeah. Well represented. If anyone wants to go back and hit pause on this episode, it was episode 95, and it was almost like 4 years to the day.
Well, it took us 4 years to do the new record. So
oh, okay.
That's about how that works out for us.
That is about how it works out. It was a post-Thanksgiving episode, which is what this will be as well. So welcome. How's your cooking been? You couldn't cook 4 years ago. Can you cook now?
No, I can't. No? Okay. I have less.
That's what people
cook less.
Cook less. That's what people were kind of. You know, that's the question they wanted us to ask for your follow up.
Yeah, putting me on a cooking show isn't the wisest thing.
We're on the music part, so it's the second
right.
half.
Okay.
So, Lessons in Tenderness, new record.
Yes.
Really interesting. So 4 years. Take us through those 4 years. A lot of couch surfing, a lot of wandering. How did the record get started, or the process of getting made?
It was me and John. John's the newbie because he's been in the band for about 2.5 years. But me and Tommy, who was the old drummer, we started working on Lesson in Tenderness. And Todd. I don't know. Just the slow... I write songs... I can write about 7 minutes worth of music per year. That's what I've learned.
Well, I mean, your songs are only like 2.5 minutes anyway. So that's like 3.5 songs.
That's
a good ratio.
There's a lot of bad stuff that I write, but it's about 7 minutes of quality music per year.
It's not seven continuous
year.
Minutes.
It's not, so yeah, there's a lot of, there's bad breaks. And then,
So you ended up, you took a tour to Texas and California, you ended up living in a practice space in Orange County. What was the name of the practice space, and what was it like living in there?
Well, I would just went, so we were on, Burger Records did Salutations, and Burger Records did Lesson in Tenderness, who are good friends of ours, and my favorite label.
Amazing label.
And I went to Burger Records, having never been in the store. It's a record label and a storefront. So I went out there, figuring out. I just decided I was going to live with them for a while. I liked them. I hadn't physically met them, but I talked to them on the phone. They'd done a record, and I really liked everything they were doing. So I went out there to live with them. But I learned that they lived in the store. Like, they didn't even have apartments themselves. So
do they have bedrooms?
They don't. No. One of the guys mostly sleeps in the back room of the store, and the other guy sleeps in a van that they own in the parking lot behind the store.
I remember when Darren and I, our first apartment, if you want to call it, it was essentially a room in New York, and there was one odd, just random piece of drywall that was in a corner. And so Darren shoved a mattress in there, and I just slept in the living room, and that was fine.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, that was fine. So...
you were doing better than Sean and Lee are doing from Burger Records.
I mean, is it now just like a point of pride? I mean, I feel like Burgers should be doing well enough that they could get at least
sink all the money back into putting... They, right about the time I think they could get a nice apartment, there's another record they hear and they want to put that out too.
Or another festival.
Yeah.
So where did you live? If they were living in the back of the store in a van, where did you...
Well, we know from New York City about having rental practice spaces, which isn't as... necessary in Los Angeles because people have basements and things there that we don't have where you can make a lot of noise. But I remember sitting on the couch. I had a book that I pulled off the rack. I was slowly realizing that staying with the Burger Records guys was not going to work out for me. And
did the van have a back seat?
What?
Did the van have a back seat?
We had Lee's sleeping in the van, so he had a back seat, but you don't want to share a van. I had my own van.
Okay.
I just looked into practice spaces because we were finished. There's a member of the band, Adam Meisterhans, who plays on the Lesson Tenderness record, who was from West Virginia. He's living in Nashville now as a studio musician. He's a really excellent player. And he had done the tour, and I wanted to get him on the record because he knew all the songs. So it was also about the cheapest way to live and get Adam Meisterhans to play guitar on the record. So I just looked up practice spaces in the Orange County area, which is where Burger Records is, and ended up living in that practice space for about 2 months.
Did anybody say anything? Did they know, or were you just very careful?
No, they really didn't care. I almost lucked out because the practice space was going under. They had just lost the lease. So when I asked if I could live there, they said you can, or not live there. If I asked if I could have a space, they said, well, we only have it for 2 more months. But the thing about that was there's a lot of bands that have been there for years, and they didn't like the fact that they were getting kicked out. So there was rowdy parties in there almost every night. I mostly actually slept in my van outside of the practice space and then would work and hang in there all day. But it was...
And you talked about recording the record, recording the instruments during the day, and then recording the vocals at night. What made you split up the process?
Necessity, because it was so loud. I mean, even the night was like really late night. It would be when all the partying was done, when everyone went to bed. I would hang at Burger Records in the back room and watch TV and stuff till like 4 in the morning, and then go back over to the practice space and see if someone was still making noise, and then... record all the quiet stuff, do the tambourines and things like that.
Can we hear a song?
Absolutely.
What are you going to play first?
What should we play first? Yeah. This is the last song on the Lesson in Tenderness record, and a song that we've never played acoustically before. It involves a lot of rocking, so we'll see what we can do.
After living in the van, you moved to LA to keep to mix the record, right?
There's a point, in the practice space there wasn't a shower or anything. There's a bathroom. I had pretty good athlete's foot going on, so I was washing my feet in the sink a lot and I remember going and playing a show, like an acoustic show at a college that they invited me to do, and just, like, begging to go into the dorms and use the shower, so... Actually...
How much begging? Like, please? Or just like, hey, just a casual, can I just check out the showers?
It was more like, I just kept hanging out with them. like I was like, all right, we're good here. And then they were talking about like a senior art show, and I was like, cool, man, what's going on with that? Like, I loved senior art shows. Let's check that out. And then like just kept hanging till I was eventually back in the room.
And how was the shower?
It's amazing.
So from there, washing and sleeping in the van in the practice space.
I went up to L.A. I have friends up there as well. We got our mutual friend, Taylor Cohen.
TC.
Filmmaker, director.
Lover.
Well, I crashed with him for a while, which meant he was already crashing on someone's couch. So I started crashing behind the couch that he was already crashing on. So that was a pretty good run there. They had a lot of guys in that house, so you know you can squeeze in.
Yeah, no one's gonna notice.
One more guy behind the couch with the guy crashing on the couch is gonna work. But eventually, a buddy of mine went on tour, and I got to take his room. A dude that I played in a band with, Kyle Thomas, let me take his bedroom for a while, so that's where I did a lot of the...
Yeah, I saw that great photo of you, Matt, and him from like your first tour together back in the day.
Yeah.
So, being at his house, you also had access to some of his gear and equipment.
He didn't have a lot of stuff at the time. He had a beautiful backyard with a palm tree that was an umbrella that blocked all the sun out, and it was the true Los Angeles experience. He had some quality weirdo roommates who I like a lot, and a blind cat, which I didn't realize was blind the whole time I lived there. It wasn't until... I was just always doing stuff with... Cats are great. They don't need eyesight, I learned. We watched the season finale, or the series finale of The Office together, and the cat got it, and it couldn't even see.
Sorry. So did all of these kind of rotating influences and settings help shape the sound of the record or influence you, or all the kind of downtime that you had of just kind of hanging out allow you to evolve your sound from the previous release?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, like I said, it was 4 years between releases. There's a lot of evolving sounds already. Just trying... Being out there was good because there's a lot of bands from Los Angeles that I like a lot. So being surrounded by contemporary musicians who are doing stuff that I'm into is cool. I think some of the earlier records were more influenced by 60s and 70s bands and just trying... I was catching up with what was going on right now.
Who were some of the bands that influenced the sound on this record?
A lot of the contemporary folk bands, a lot of the burger bands, I'd say. I was hanging with the guys in the Memories, and I like their tunes. We did a tour when we were doing the West Coast. We were on tour with Natural Child, who I'm a huge fan of. So all of their sounds have come in. It's other people are influenced by those earlier bands, but they're doing their own thing, taking it in their own direction. I want to do that. I want to stay contemporary, but also love the music that I've always loved.
Yeah, and what sounds did you layer in? Because, I mean, in the last time you were here, you talked a lot about the Beatles and the perfect soundwriting and the 60s and 70s influence. What actual noises or sonic soundscapes have you added on top of the music that you already love and make?
Well, I was trying to... The hardest thing is when you don't play keyboards and trying to get some tasteful synths, I think. There's a lot of untasteful synthesizing going on these days, so you need to find just the right tones that make sense with what you're doing. I think when you're trying to incorporate it into live instruments or acoustic instruments, there are certain sounds that clash... And there's certain sounds that work perfectly together, and there's other sounds that clash perfectly. So,
Can we get another song?
Absolutely.
What are you gonna play?
Do Always. One, two, three, four.
Yeah.
can't seem to leave on time.
One of the greatest things to come out of the new record is the Water Than Me video. How long did that take? Well, just to, for people who have not seen it, it's you essentially just moving your hips, walking down the street in multiple locations, in multiple clothing outfits and changes. How long did it take for that to be filmed? All right, and how did you film it?
Me and Johnny D, the drummer of the band, shot it in 2 days. It's an idea I had forever, and I kept throwing it out there for talking to you, Taylor Cohen, to many director friends, and they were like, well, okay, that's a good idea, well, but what about this idea? And I said, this is simple. I think we can do it. And John said, I got a better idea. And then we talked about that idea, and then I would convince him to still do this idea. And I thought...
What was the idea that lost?
We got...
Well, a slow motion video of you going to be on a hoverboard and everybody kind of throwing things at you.
John has this still might come out, so okay. It's a slow. He wants me to get broken up with and then walk outside of my apartment, get on a hoverboard, and then go down the street while rows of people on either side of the street throw food at me.
I'd watch that for 2.5 minutes.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
Actually for the last song that we just. Song we just played is
perfect. That's perfect.
It's just us. Basically, he just wants to strap something onto the bed of his truck that he thinks he can nail the video in one try.
And throw us up a Fletcher.
Yeah. Just get
I said,
it out there.
If that thing you strap on in the back of your truck is not aligned just perfectly, that's a lot of food that's going to waste.
Yeah, that's true. But you could do a test run, like pantomiming the food being thrown. Yeah.
This is why we come on podcasts, to get those different food ideas.
Yeah, there you go. You're not a food guy. But for the video, I mean, it looks like it's actually shot over the course of a year just from all the outfit changes, 2 days. And
I brought two gigantic Rolly suitcases of outfits. And there's a point where I'm going up an escalator. Now,
and there's a suitcase there.
There's a suitcase. That's one of the suitcases. Now, what you can learn from is that Forever 21 doesn't care what you do on their escalator. Because we tried to nail it, so we were crossing at the same time. We probably did it 4 or 5 times, right?
We were in there for like at least 25 minutes.
Yeah, we were 25 minutes. Not one employee questioned what we were doing when we were like signaling to each other on the escalators to say when we were going to get on. And also, there's, if you look at it, there's a woman dancing on the escalator that John's on with a camera, and that was completely unplanned, but it's the greatest part of the whole video.
It's really good. I did actually wonder what that suitcase was on the video, because it's just so weird.
It's one of the two suitcases I had that was full of outfit changes.
And did I see that your wedding made it into the video as well?
My actual wedding, yeah. My brother also helped shoot it as well, did some good work, but probably the best thing he did was... He was, groomsman. He was my only groomsman.
He's best man.
The best man.
The groomsman, the best. I mean, he's got a lot of hats.
When you go to City Hall, I don't know, you need a guy.
Yeah, you need
he
one
was my guy.
He's a witness.
And he said, I know this is your wedding, but you're going to really want this shot. And so he made me do my hip wiggle dance at the chapel.
I mean,
at City Hall.
Your wife looked like she was a good sport.
She looked grumpy, but that was even better.
Yeah, yeah.
She is a good sport.
She is a good sport. Well, I want to make sure we have time for one more song. Thanks for coming on the show again. Hopefully it won't be 4 years for the next time. Where can people get...
We just got out of recording studio doing a new EP.
Oh.
Last week.
Oh, perfect. So where can people find the record, find you, see your shows, offer you a place to shower, etc.?
We're on all the music sources if you want to listen to the tunes, and we don't have anything coming up. We're going right into the holiday season here. So.
Yeah. By the way, when
we play around New York a lot, and Bryce just asked us to go play this festival he set up in Atlanta, so we'll be hopefully down there in March.
Cool.
As well as doing a little bit of touring down there, and we play around the New York area a lot.
Where we last left you, final question. You were working on your Twitter game. Anything to update 4 years later?
I mean, I get one good one like every 4 months.
That's on par with your music writing.
Yes, you're right. That's
Okay, cool.
It's like, that's my entire artistic style.
I'm sensing a pattern here. Well, big thank you to Gorilla Tacos. And if you haven't done it yet, we are nominated for Taste Awards for Best Radio Show and Best Podcast. If you go to bit.do/stvote, that's bit.do/stvote. We'd really appreciate it if you voted for us. Vote twice, podcast and radio.
Vote for Snacky Tunes.
Thanks. Well, thanks for coming on. Hope you have a good Thanksgiving. What are you going to take us out with?
This is a song about, I work night shifts. I live the nightlife still. And my wife, she works days, so this is a song about her letting me sleep because she always trying to wake me up in the morning, and that's rude.
Right. for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.